Thank you for coming. So last year we got an invitation to come to Princeton University and give a program for some of the students there. Partly it was yoga, and they were interested in learning. I was trained in some Tibetan styles of yoga in the monastery, so they asked us if we would come and teach that. And I don't know if you know the university, it was in Dillon Gym, and like 200 kids showed up, and that's kind of weird. And then they asked me to speak at the art museum, I think, about my business. So I was in a business, that's a long story. But anyway, I gave a talk about that, and then there were two young physicists in the crowd, and after the talk, they ran up, and they were all excited. And they said, what you described has a lot of applications to quantum physics, you know? And we think you should come back to the university and give a talk on quantum physics and the applications to physics. And so I said, okay. And then I don't know how it ended up here and not the university, but maybe next time it'll be at the university. I think the person who was in charge of it went to Europe or something. So anyway, we're here. I think next year I have to repeat it at the university for the physics people, but I'll practice on you guys, okay? So this is the story. I went to Princeton University, and I was really doing well. I was invited to the White House. I got a medal from the president for scholarship, and I was very happy. And then in the middle of my education in the college, I got a call, and they said, your mother died today, you know? And I was like, I was terribly, crushed, you know, completely crushed. Because we were very close. I have four brothers total, and we had a very tight family, and I was just crushed. And then I didn't know what to do exactly. And then I heard later that my father died and my brother died. And then I remember I was going to class one day. I had never missed a class. And there was an Indian student in my class, and we were, should I use the other mic, you think? Or is that, yeah? Maybe I use the other mic.
Better?
Worse. Same. So anyway, there's an Indian boy in the class, and he was sitting under a tree outside of the 1879 Hall, if you know the campus. And he said, don't go to class, sit here with me. And I don't know why, I was in a mood, right? And I said, okay, I'll sit with you, you know? And he said, you can't learn anything here, you have to go to India, you know? And if you want to know what happened to your mother, or you want to know all these things, you have to go to India. And so right there, we made a plan, you know? And I don't know why, I just said, okay. And I took a year off of school, and you know, got my scholarship money sent over. He was supposed to meet me in the New Delhi airport. This is in the days when India was interesting. Now it was like a chaotic, terrible place, and people starving on the streets everywhere all the time. And anyway, I got there, and he never came. He wasn't there. And I had a 3-month ticket, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any money. So I just took off. I went on a bus. I asked somebody, you know, I want to meet Buddhist people. How do you meet Buddhist people? You know, where do they live? I heard Buddhism started here, you know. Then the guy was very funny. He looked at his watch and he said, you're a little bit late, you know. And I said, what do you mean? He says, oh, Buddhists all died out 1,000 years ago, you know. And he's like, good luck, man. And then I met someone, and they said, oh, Tibetan monks are coming out of Tibet. Refugees are coming out of Tibet. and maybe you can meet them, you know. So I ended up in Dharamsala, where His Holiness stays. At that time, it was very cool because you could just go to his house and knock on his door and have a conversation with him. And it's not like that now. But then, you know, I started studying there, and I stayed in Tibetan monasteries there and here in the States for 25 years, and finished the course of study there, which is called the Geshe. So when I finished and I came, I asked His Holiness, you know, what I should do, you know, what should I go back to the States and like that? And then he said, you know, when I first started my studies, he advised me to meet a lama who he had sent to the United States to serve a Mongolian Kalmyk community near here. There's a nun from there. We were friends since those days. And so I stayed there, and I met my teacher, Ken Rinpoche. And he was a great scholar, and we stayed together for 25 years. And he helped me get through the Geshe course. Then at some point, I think it was about, I don't know, 1981, he challenged me. He said, you know, now you've learned all this karma thing, you've learned about karmic seeds. Now I would like you to demonstrate that you understand it well in the real world. If you just stay in the monastery, then you will never have a chance to prove what you understand in real life. You know, if you just sit here and drink tea and meditate, you will never prove to yourself and to other people that you understand how these principles work. So he said, I want you to go to work in Manhattan and start a company. And we will help the refugees. If you make money, we'll help the refugees. And then I want you to help to build the business, say, to $1 million in a year. And let's see if you understand what we've trained you, what we've taught you. And then we had a Mexican standoff. You're not supposed to say no to your teacher. And the last thing I wanted to do was go to New York or start a business. And he, you know, so kind of we just had a silent fight. And I didn't talk about it, and he didn't talk about it. And then finally, one day he came to Rutgers and gave a very beautiful talk. And I was his driver, his cook, his laundry man, his gardener, dishwasher, toilet cleaner. And then I was driving him home, and I said, Rinpoche, that was the most beautiful talk I ever heard. And I'll do anything you want. Then he said, New York, business, you know, next week. So I helped to start a business in New York with two other people. And I asked him, what should the business be? And he said, diamond business. Then I said, I don't know a diamond from a golf ball, you know. I don't know anything about diamonds. And he said, that's okay. I saw in meditation, you have to do diamonds, you know. So I tried to join the diamond business. That's like trying to join the mafia. And I mean, the big business, is they don't hire anybody except their own relatives. Because you can walk out of the office with $1 million in your pocket, and there's no way to stop you. And but finally, I got into a business, and I helped to start a business. And then at some point, they trusted me enough to allow me to run my part of the business by myself. And then I used only the principles, which I'm going to talk about tonight. And now that business, 2 years ago, it was sold to Warren Buffett. It reached $250 million per year, $250 million per year. And I think it has, globally, it's about 10,000 workers now. And we started with three people and three chairs and a little table. In we rented a room from a guy, another guy. And so he forced me to do an experiment to show if I understood how to tweak reality in a real world situation, you know, not just in meditation or yoga or something like that. He challenged me to show that I could direct events at will by tweaking reality. And it was very successful. And, you know, at some point, Doubleday called me and said, will you write a book about it? And they gave me a lot of money. And I said, I'll pay to write a book. They said, no, we'll pay you. And then that book now is all over the world. And we go to hundreds of places. I think we give trainings in hundreds of cities, 156 cities around the world. And we have groups there, and we train business people. And at some point, some physicist got a hold of me and said, you should apply these things to how science works, because the principles you've described would be very interesting in a scientific context, right? So pretend you are a physicist at the university, which is the people I prepared this talk for, and I'm not trying to confuse you, this is what I prepared, okay? And I think whatever you do, you will find it helpful for your life, okay? I teach a lot of business people all over the world, many countries. Nowadays, a lot of people have asked me to speak about relationships and how do you apply these principles to relationships, and we're doing that. I think in Hamburg next week, we're giving a talk about that. And then in Moscow, some business talks. So it's very popular all over the world. This is the first time I've tried to do it in a scientific context. So let's go. The point is that I think what we did with the business shows that with no training, right? I was not trained in diamond business, and I had no training in finance or advertising or marketing or product development. I just used principles that were outlined 2,000 years ago. One of the most important figures in history who described these principles is Arya Nagarjuna. His name is Nagarjuna. And I put his picture on the front of your reading, okay? So that's a traditional carving from the Dalai Lama's palace in Tibet of Nagarjuna. He described in the 3rd century AD, he described the principles we're going to talk about tonight. And so I thought it was fitting that we put him on the cover. The title of this talk is called 6 Interpretations of the Universe. Some of you have had a teaching called Mahamudra, and this is modified from that. I like to call it a better history of time. Okay, I had a pleasure to meet someone who's involved with printing Stephen Hawking's books in New York recently. And so actually, I would like to take on Mr. Hawking and try not to overthrow science, but to try to perfect it. I think the ideas in which I was trained, if they were applied to science in general and quantum physics in particular, I think it would clarify a lot of issues. And it would sort of, in my perception, perfect science itself. I don't know, sometimes I like to go to a book fairs, you know. Princeton has a really good one every year. I used to deliver the books there. And there are thousands and thousands of books are sold for like a week and a half. And I used to enjoy taking old science books. By the way, if you don't have a reading, can you raise your hand? And Charles will supply you with one, I hope. Just keep your hand up, okay? He didn't memorize everybody. He's making his way to the front. I really enjoy going to book sales, right? Used book fairs like Bookman's, and then I like to buy old science books, like from 50 years ago or 100 years ago, and they are really funny, you know? They are full of really useless and wrong information, you know? And but presented very seriously and very, what do you call it? Very formally and as if it were God's truth, you know? And I'm sure the students who were required to read those textbooks felt like, oh, that must all be true, you know? And now from 50 years hindsight, even a lay person, I'm not a scientist, you pick up one of those books and it's obviously crazy and full of mistaken ideas, okay? I would propose that the most modern mathematical presentations of quantum physics at present will seem exactly like that in 50 years, okay? Every generation believes that their presentation of science is the last one and is very sophisticated and very correct. And we live by that, right? And then I would say, I'm saying from 50 years from now, people, you know, your grandchildren will look back and look at the Stephen Hawking's presentation and say it was ridiculous. I'm just trying to say it in advance, okay? I think there's a long way to go in that kind of thinking, and I think that these ancient ideas have a great contribution to make. These are ancient ideas, but they can be applied to your modern life. And what my Lama forced me to do was to prove them to myself in a normal context of a business in Manhattan. I think it was the fastest growing manufacturing company in the history of Manhattan, okay? Then I did my little experiment, and I didn't use any of the knowledge that was current at that time in business. I ignored it. And I went straight to these six ideas, okay? And I'm gonna try to convince you that these are useful for everything you want to do, all right? If you want to make money, or you want to find a good partner, or you have some health problem, or you're concerned about world peace, or you're a scientist and you want to take it further, I think these things are revolutionary. I think this ancient wisdom is something that could revolutionize what you do. It has revolutionized business in the countries that we go to, like in Shanghai. We just got back from Beijing and Shanghai, Guangzhou, and people are using these principles. And they passed the United States a long time ago. I don't know who makes the statistics, right? But they passed us a long time ago. And part of it, I think, is these ideas are spreading there and they are getting popular and people are making immense amounts of money with a better personal life also. They have a better personal life and they make huge amounts of money and they're happy because they are following these six principles. So I'm going to apply them to a scientific context, okay? I called it says A Better History of Time, which is already copyrighted, okay? You can't steal it. It's the name of my next book, okay? But it also says One Which Explains Apparent Singularities. So, you know, I like the idea of a singularity. It's a big idea in modern physics right now. One of the meanings of singularity is that in an event cone or something like that, that something could happen for the first time, like Big Bang. Singularity means a single instance, right? In one context. Could there have been a single event which created the universe? And a lot of modern physics is aimed at tracing back the trajectories of objects passing by us at a certain speed and predicting where and when the universe began. That's a big subject. There was a Big Bang, right? And that was a unique event. In our training, we would say there is no such thing, okay? There cannot be an event without a cause. There's a certain system called science which says that. Except they don't say it about the most important thing that ever happened, which was the creation of the universe. So they would say that everything has a cause. All things, we can identify the causes of things by performing experiments. And in that way, we can find the cause of cancer or we can cause the cause of a nuclear reaction. We can cause things to happen in the world, right? But the another meaning of singularity would be, in science, you conduct experiments, and replication is an important idea. Replication means, if I have the same circumstances, and if I undertake the same steps of the same procedure to cause a reaction, then given the same steps and given the exact same situation, right, all the causes and conditions are the same, then the result of that experiment should be the same. Like, that's the principle behind drug testing or something like that. A drug is not allowed to be released until independently different scientists can try it in controlled environments to see if it creates the same cause for everybody. Because if it kills some people and it heals some other people, then we shouldn't release it. So replication is important. Can you make the same thing happen twice by repeating the same causes, right? That idea is based upon causes. You have to accept causes to have a replication of an experiment. Experimentation only has meaning if you can repeat the causes in a controlled way and make the same thing happen again with a medicine or with a nuclear device, right? It's not going to blow up an hour early while it's still in your truck or something, okay? Like that. I mean, there should be causes and you should be able to trace them. So we're going to discuss singularities in the sense of, for example, we know this is a beautiful building. I've been here once before, I think. It's a beautiful building. Something is holding the building up. Okay, there are certain chemical or elements in the wood. They are arranged in certain chains of molecules. The iron underpinning has a certain power. The concrete, which is underlying the structure of the building, has a certain power. All of those objects, the beams that hold up the ceiling right now, and the foundation which holds up the beams, and any iron that's between them, they have qualities inside of them, right? And we test those qualities, and we make iron beams of a certain width, and we have engineers decide how wide the beams have to be and the angles, the correct angles of the roof, the pitch of the roof. And we replicate or we repeat the conditions which will keep the building up, because that's in our interest. We don't want buildings falling down at random, right? And that's a lot of science. A lot of science, as we experience it in our everyday lives, is, can we measure the qualities of the elements or the chemicals which compose an object, and then can we predict what that object will do? Will it hold up the roof or not? Okay. Those are general rules. Iron has a certain capacity. Wood has a certain weight-bearing capacity. Certain pitches, angles of pitch in the roof are required for those objects to do what they do. Okay. I gave this talk for the first time. I think Margie and I were in the car today. Where is Margie? She was my driver 15, 20 years ago. Yeah, she's still driving me. And she's like, you gave this talk like 18 years ago in the Quaker House in New York. And it was interesting. It was 1999. And I was talking about the World Trade Center. I don't know how many people were there. Maybe three or four of you were there. I was talking about the World Trade Center, and I said, the iron in the beams and the girders of the World Trade Center, it's called an element, right? Element means it's a unique substance that has its own qualities. Element means you can't break it down further than that. It deserves to be Fe, is it? Part of the periodic table. It deserves it because it's an element, right? And then it has certain qualities of it. So you make beams out of iron and you don't make them out of chlorine or something, because it won't hold up the World Trade Center. You know, we talked about that. We were talking about it in 1999 and in New York. And then I was like, But singularities are important. There's a thing about singularities. Then they said, what do you mean singularity? I mean one person's unique experience with iron.
Okay.
One person's own interaction with iron, right? Like, when you talk about the qualities of iron, can you divorce it from the interaction, unique interactions that each of us has with iron, you see? Is it possible to talk about iron without talking about iron falling down on people, certain people? And why does it do that on certain people? You see what I mean? Why does it fall down, killed 3,000 people, right? Iron fell down and killed 3,000 people, right? So that iron didn't have the capacity to hold up those buildings. Then you say, no, the iron never lost its capacity to hold up the buildings. Other events occurred which deprived it of that ability in that circumstance. That's what I'm calling a singularity, okay? There was a unique series of events. An airplane hit the tower, gasoline exploded, certain temperatures were reached. The iron never lost its elemental quality. It was subjected to other circumstances, and then it lost its power to hold up the building. You see what I mean? I'm calling that a singularity. I'm talking about 3,000 human beings' interaction with iron. You see? And I say, what I'm trying to talk about tonight is you can't divorce the element from the human interaction with the element. You see? What was the cause to do with the iron in the World Trade Center when the plane hit it? And why did people die? You see? It's not enough. I claim, it's not enough to talk about the qualities of iron given perfect circumstances, given controlled temperatures where it doesn't reach its melting point. It's not enough to talk about iron that way. Try to get a new idea. This, I always think it's like talking to, try to grasp this. It's illogical to talk about the qualities of iron and not talk about how it affects individuals in every circumstance possible. Okay? It's not enough for science to describe the physical properties of iron. And it's not enough to make a building code which will describe how the iron should hold up the building. If it's still possible that any occurrence should come about and kill people who are sitting in that room when the iron fails. Do you get me? We can't divorce the qualities of iron from the experiences of the people around the iron, because somebody might die. Okay? It's important. Somebody might get blown up by this nuclear device. Okay? Take people are very concerned about Iran and North Korea. Probably they're concerned about us also, I imagine. Okay? And they're like, are they gonna let loose this nuclear device, right? So if you're a scientist, a lot of the bomb work was done here at the Institute for Advanced Study. I used to work there. There used to be a particle reactor here, Forrestal campus. I used to work there. And Einstein was here, and Oppenheimer was here, and a lot of the development of the bomb was done here on Princeton campus, okay? Credibility of modern physics is solely derived from the fact that Einstein's equations on a Princeton University blackboard blew up two cities and killed, I don't know, a million people or something. You see what I mean? We believe in physicists because some guy was with a frizzy hair. He makes me feel good. Some guy with frizzy hair was able to write equations on a blackboard in a little classroom in this civilized university and blow up a city with it, you know? And then we're like, wow, he must know something, you know? Like, I don't know what that stuff is that he's writing. I don't even know what EMC squared means. But it blew up a city. He must be onto something, you know what I mean? But the question is, a higher question, can you divorce the physics required to blow up a city from the lives of the people in that city, you see? Can you divorce the capacity to explode a nuclear device from events in Iran and North Korea now, which could lay this country to waste in a decade or two decades. You see what I mean? Your lives and your family and your country are wasteland. You know, can you divorce the mathematics required to make a nuclear device blow up from what causes might bring that nuclear device down upon us in the country who made it? You see what I mean? Can science ignore those issues, you see? And I'm not talking moral issues, okay? I'm not talking social issues. I'm not here to talk about Iran or North Korea or anything else. It's not the point, okay? Is there a branch that could, I wouldn't even say a branch, is there an integral part of modern physics which is incomplete because it doesn't take into account unique interactions with the elements by human life, by human beings, okay? Try to imagine that. When they teach you the periodic table in chemistry class in high school, they're also talking about kindness and compassion. Not because it's the right thing to do, but because it affects the periodic table. Wow, I like that. You gotta go in there, okay? That's what I'm trying to sell you tonight. Okay, that there's a moral component to how the periodic table behaves. And if you don't get it, you will never be a good scientist. And your stuff will blow up innocent people. You see, because they go together. What happens to the iron when individuals who are not lucky run into it is also a matter to be investigated by quantum physics. And I'm not saying the religion department. I'm saying the physics department. There are, in this system, there are a broader concept of how elements work and of how atomic particles work. And that has everything to do with how human beings treat each other. And that's like cool. You know, it sounds sexy, right? But if you could demonstrate that it's true, you know, then that would be something, right? So we're going to take off on that. Okay, there are six ancient schools of thought whose main ideas I have summarized here. I like them because they are a staircase up to the highest place where quantum physics meets compassion. Okay? And again, not in some touchy-feely New Age way. I'm saying your nuclear devices will work better if you understand how your behavior is affecting them. Okay? Very interesting. All right? Your iron will change. The properties of iron itself change in the presence of an extraordinarily compassionate person. And that has to be measured, and that has to be established. And then science is perfected, you see? So here we go. We're going to work our way up through six schools of thought. These occurred historically in the last 2,500 years in India. They got more and more refined, and then they reached what I would consider its highest refinement, okay? So here we go. First page of your thing. By the way, I am giving you a break. You can't sit there and listen to physics all night without cookies. That's a basic principle. So I guess we'll go till about, we'll go like another half hour, and then I'll give you guys a pee-pee break and a cookie break, okay? I put the six ideas in Tibetan just because I love them very much. This is translated from the Sanskrit into ancient Tibetan. This is the way they're presented in my monastery, okay? 25 years training, distilled into two pages, okay? That was a trick. Okay? Is it true that the physical matter in a wall is unchanging, unitary, and independent? Okay? I'd like to draw your attention. There's three qualities there, right? One is unchanging, one is unitary, and one is independent. Is iron, Fe, right? Is iron unchanging, unitary, and independent? I think it might be easier to say constant. Okay? Is iron constant? Are the properties of iron always the same? Okay? It should be if it's what you call an element. That's the meaning of an element. I mean, an element means that iron is treated as a separate, unique substance because it displays its own unique properties, which no other element displays. You see what I mean? You put iron in the girders, you don't put calcium or something like that, because iron has a certain properties to it. And the word element suggests that it always has those properties. Okay? Iron always has certain properties. You can take iron from any mine in the world, you refine it in a certain way, you get it to a certain purity, and you form it into a certain girder with certain dimensions, and it should have the same weight-bearing capacity that any other iron in the world has, because iron is elemental, and it has its own unique properties. Am I right? I mean, you're trusting it right now, okay? Like you're sitting under it right now, okay? If iron could suddenly change, if iron around the world just changed every 6 months and became like marshmallow, okay, then lots of people would die in buildings created from iron girders, okay? But it doesn't. Or does it? Or does it, you see? Not in controlled circumstances, right? In a laboratory where all conditions are equal, iron always acts the same. So maybe. We'll get into that. But what about the World Trade Center, you see? What about the World Trade? In that case, iron's properties were not constant, you see? To certain people's experience, to the people who were in that building, to their experience, the qualities of iron were not sufficient and were not constant enough, and they died. It's an important question, you see? Does iron have a constant, fixed, unchangeable quality that other elements don't have? It must, or we wouldn't call it an element, and it wouldn't get in to be in the periodic table, okay? But it doesn't, okay? Some people crash their iron car and die when the iron kills them. Some people don't when they crash their car also, their iron car. Some people die. Some people don't die. Then you can say, oh, there's other circumstances. They were going at a higher speed. They had the seatbelt on. This person didn't have a seatbelt on. But then be a real scientist, okay? Be a real scientist. When was the last time you were a real scientist? When you were six, okay? And no, I did. Somebody died. My friend died in a car accident. I went to mom, you know. Why did he die? Their car getting a crash. Well, you know, lots of cars getting crashes and people don't die. Yeah, but he was sitting on the right side. Yeah, but why did he die? His side of the car got hit by the other car. But mom, you know, she's getting impatient. She wants to cook or something. And you're like, but mom, you know, why was he on the right side of the car? Well, sometimes he sits in the back. Why was he in the right side of the car when the car hit the other car and the iron crushed him? You know, why, mom? And then you know what crushed your, you know what destroyed your scientific attitude, right? Your mother. And what did she say? Don't ask that. It's just the way it is. Okay? These are the two most evil comments in scientific inquiry. Okay? That's just the way it is. Stop asking me. Okay? All right? No, I'm not kidding, okay? You can't divorce the qualities of iron from the consequences or the interaction it has with human beings. You see? A scientist must ask. He must be the child and say, why was he sitting on the right side of the car? And why did the other car hit the right side of the car? And why was it just enough iron to crush his chest and kill him? Because not just because science has to relate to human beings. I'm not saying that, okay? I'm not saying we need a kinder science and scientists shouldn't undertake any experiment which might hurt a bunny or a human. I'm not saying that. It's probably true, but I'm not saying that. I'm saying the missing part of scientific theory is the perceptions that Johnny had in the front seat of getting crushed, and it changed the quality of the iron in the car. His perceptions of the iron in the car are part of the quality of the iron in the car, of the element of iron. You try to grasp what I'm saying, okay? The interaction of a human being with the element of iron, it further defines the qualities of iron, okay? Why? Because iron isn't constant, and it changes, and it's not an element, and there's no such thing as an element, okay? All chemicals, all substances, qualities change upon interaction with humans and other living creatures, okay? You can say, what is it? Me and him have this argument, Heisenberg, I don't know who. Anyway, the presence of the observer changes the movement of an atomic particle. I did gemology degree. I did two. One is GIA, it's the American one. It's ridiculous. It's like, is an emerald A, green, B, red, C, you know? Then I said, this is stupid. I finished it, but then I took the British one, you know, the gemological 2Ms Institute of Great Britain, you know. They're tough. And they require you to learn, what do you call those things? Spectroscopes and refractometers. And you're supposed to understand the nature of light as it's refracted through a gemstone. You're required to know those things, right? Then you go all through that stuff, and then you ask your teacher, so is it like waves of light coming through the gemstone, or is it particles of light coming through a gemstone? How does light from the sun reach the earth? And an honest teacher will say, we don't know yet, okay? We don't understand it. Then you say, why? And you say, because light behaves in two different ways which are contradictory to each other. If you take it through a refraction grating, it behaves like a wave. If you shoot it like ping pong balls through the opening in the grating, it behaves like particles. The two are contradictory, but they both fit the evidence. Okay, and then quantum physics says the presence of somebody watching it changes how it acts. Okay, the presence of an observer changes how the light acts. It goes from a wave to a particle. Okay. And you tell me iron is constant? If light itself is not? Got it? There's no such thing as an element, and it's not constant. It can fall on you, and it can squash you. And you better be interested about this, because you might be the person who gets squashed. Okay? All right. Anyway, number one says, the principle that they decided in ancient India was nothing is constant, okay? There is no constant, okay? It depends upon the observer. And quantum physics is just catching up to that, okay? By the way, I'm not just doing some, what do you call it? Pie in the sky, new age thing. By the end, it doesn't mean anything unless we relate it to your day-to-day life, okay? I'm not just trying to talk about science. By the end, I will tie it to your life. Getting your husband to wash the dishes. You know? Important stuff. So, to me, to talk about the theory doesn't have any meaning, even in this hour or two, if we don't relate it to your real life, your own life. You know? Can you use it to get financial security? Can you use this? I did. $250 million company. Can you use it? I call it oxygen money. Oxygen money means, okay, by the time you're 40 or something, you make all the money you need, and you just stop working, and you do what you want to do. And it just keeps coming. You see, it's in here, okay? But also personal relationships, and you can change your, if you can change iron, you can change your partner, okay? You can. And there are principles for that. We can talk about it if we have time. All right, step number two. Rangya tupi zeyuki jupi dagmeba. Rangya tupi, say rangya. Say it, okay, just for good luck. Rangya tupi zeyuki tupi dag Meba. It means, Zeya here, the important word here is Zeya. Zeya means substantial. That quality within a substance which allows it to interact with another substance, okay? There must be some substance to iron which helps it hold up a building, right? There must be some stuff, solid stuff in iron, substance, that allows it to affect something else, okay? It's different to go out into a battle with an iron sword than a wooden sword, right? Iron has a different quality. It is substantial. It is more substantial. It can cause an effect in a softer substance, like somebody's chest. You know, in 2,000 years ago in some battle, if you had a brass sword, and then your army came out with iron swords, then you won the battle because your swords were more substantial. What does it mean, substantial? It had more power, innate power within itself to poke holes in other people's bodies. Okay? That's all. I mean, nuclear weapons aren't different. They're the same. We're still interested in this. You see what I mean? This is harder. Something in iron is harder, and it can create an effect better than something which is made of wood. Cool? We don't put wooden tires on our cars. We put steel tires on our cars because they last longer. Okay, like that. I was in a plane today, and I was happy they didn't make it out of wood. Okay? I have a friend in Beijing. He's trying to sell plastic Boeing planes to the Chinese government. And he's trying to convince them that plastic is better than steel or aluminum. But that's another thing. And then there's the illusion of, what do you call it? How do you call it? Of will, okay? There's the illusion of will. If I had a steel sword rather than a wooden one, then I could push it through things. I could make it go through other things. I could cause an effect. If I had something which was more substantial, I could create a more substantial effect. You see? When a particle hits another particle and causes a reaction, what's really happening? Okay? Is it possible to cause another thing? Step two is asking this question, you see? Is it possible to cause another thing? Of course it is. Give me an example. I turn the key and the car starts. Okay? That turning the key closes the electrical system. The battery power is able to go to the spark plugs. They spark. It ignites the gasoline and the pistons, and my car starts. Okay? I caused the car to start by turning the key. Okay? Am I right? There's a substance in the key, iron, which is hard enough, and also, conducts electricity. And I close the circuit, and the car starts. Am I right? Yes or no? Just not. I got to make sure. I need confirmation you're not asleep. Okay? Do you start your car with a key? Or will you give me your key right now? You won't, right? Because you believe the car is started by the key. You won't come up here and I'll give me your keys and then try to get home. You won't do it. That proves you believe the key starts the car, okay? No, it's just, okay? You say the key causes the car to start. I ask you, does it always cause the car to start? Then you say no. Then I ask you, will you buy a car at a car lot if the dealer tells you this car only starts 3 days a week? You know, not unless you're really hard up. I could give you my old Volvo that I drove until a couple weeks ago. That has the same quality. Try to grasp this, okay? Try to pretend there's a world where people understand twice as much as we do. And when you say, my key doesn't always start my car, they think you're crazy to try to start your car with a key. They think you are primitive. to the extreme. They think you are like a cave, worse than a caveman. Okay, you think a key could start your car? You say yes. And then they say, well, does it always start when you turn the key? And you say no. And then they just look at you. And then you say, but it's not the key's fault. The battery died, or there wasn't gas, or it was too cold, or, and they just look at you. Like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, there's something else there. There's the cause of a unique interaction with elements by any given person, and that must be taken into consideration when you discuss elements, okay? Iron only works in the presence of a person with certain things about them. And if you don't have them, then the roof will fall down and kill you, or your key won't work. Try to get it, okay? Iron doesn't work the same for different people. There's no such thing as the element of iron. It does not have a unique capacity to push through things which are softer than it. There's no such thing. For certain people, iron will work that way. And for other people, it will not work that way. And lots of people got killed by the iron swords that they forged. Right? Yeah, but somebody else got a hold of it and stabbed them. Duh! Okay? Why? Didn't they bring your mother in? Don't ask that. It's just the way it is. You know? Why did this soldier get a hold of the other soldier's sword and stab him with the sword that his army made? I don't know. It just happened. You know? Don't ask those things. Okay? Number two is saying iron doesn't have a unique capacity to create an effect. Iron doesn't have a unique capacity to do anything. Okay? What was idea number one? Iron doesn't have a unique quality to it. Different people will experience iron differently. Number two, iron doesn't have a unique ability to do anything. It will work for some people and it won't work for other people. And if you knew that, you'd never be stuck out in the middle of the desert with a car that's not starting, which happened to my friend the other day. They called AAA. They tried for an hour to start the car. It didn't start. They called AAA, you know, and that's like an hour where we live. You know, some guy in Goodyear, Arizona gets in his tow truck and maybe the key starts it. And then he comes to get you. And then the key worked. The guy wasn't quite there yet. He was within sight of the tow truck, and suddenly the key started working. Try to explain that to the guy. He just drove for 2 hours, you know? And in discussing the capacity of iron to cause an effect in another material, you must discuss why it works for some people and why it doesn't work for other people in the key of their car, because maybe the power of the iron is coming from the people and not from the iron. Okay? Maybe the ability of the iron to start the car isn't in the iron. Maybe it's in the person whose fingers are turning it. Try to get comfortable with that, okay? Try to get comfortable with that. You cannot speak of the qualities of iron, and you cannot speak of iron's ability to affect another element without speaking of the qualities of the person who's doing it. And physics is just catching up to that, okay? With the light thing, waves and particle thing. The presence of the observer changes the behavior of physical matter. Try to grasp. The chair you're sitting on is not fixed. There's nothing about the cellulose that can keep you up. Okay? It's something about you that's keeping the chair up. How can you have an entire system by which the whole world lives, okay? Forget Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism. That's not the religion of this world. It's science. Everybody in the world believes science. On Sundays or Saturdays or Fridays, they go to this house and they worship some picture, right? But everybody's living by science. They get in a plane because they believe in science. And they believe it won't fall down, okay? And science is incomplete. It doesn't work. Buildings fall down. Cars don't start, okay? Someone reads your books 50 years from now, they're going to laugh at you. I'm just trying to protect you, okay? All right. Step number three, then we'll take a break, okay? I promise. Sometimes he lies. Suk dan sung zin ki tsema tse shen ki tong. Say suk dan sung zin ki tsema tse shen ki tong. So here's a new idea. I plant trees, and I live in a wild place. I live up on a mesa in Arizona. It's empty. I don't see a single light at night in front of me. It's beautiful, and you can go hiking for days, and you won't meet anybody, and you see amazing, beautiful things, you know. And so I try to grow roses because I like roses. I like to offer roses, so I have all these rose plants, and then. The first time I started growing them, the deer came and ate them all. Thorns don't work, okay? I don't know why. But they just eat them. They have very sensitive lips, and they avoid the thorns, and they pick off the petals and everything and the leaves, and it's just a stick left. So I built a fence around it. Then I started some, what do you call it, plum trees. And then I found out about raccoons. So they wait until they're just about ripe. And then one night you hear all this noise, you know. And I went out with a flashlight, and there were three baby raccoons huddled together, and they had their arms around each other like this. And they were all big bellies. And they didn't run away, they just looked at me like this. And then all the plums were gone on the tree, you know. So does a branch on the left side of the tree cause the fruit on the right side of the tree? I ask you a question. Okay. Does a branch on the left side of the tree, is it a direct cause of the fruit on the other side of the tree? Okay. Yes or no? I mean, it contributes, right? It converts solar, what do you call that? Synthesis. Photosynthesis. The leaves on the left side help the fruit grow on the right side. But it's not like the fruit grew directly from the limb on the left side. You could cut off the left side limb, and the right side limb would grow, and it would continue to sustain the fruit. They are together, but they are not cause and effect, right? Because there's another cause for both of them, which is the roots and the water and the fertilizer. Try to get it, okay? The real causes are down below. In Tibetan, you know what they call a tree? They call it kangtung. Kangtung means drinks through its leg. It's a nice word, right? Trees are called drink through their legs. And the sustenance for the fruit is coming up the trunk. It's water and minerals and fertilizer, and it's being sucked up the trunk and supplied to the left side and to the right side. The real cause is in the roots, okay? It's not that the left-hand branch is causing the right-hand branch, although it may look related somehow, okay? Got it? When you start your car, the engine that you're trying to start and the person who's trying to start the engine have no cause and effect relationship at all. It's like two branches on a tree. Okay? They are together. They are touching each other. There's a point of contact. There's an event which happens right after the contact. And it's not at all related to the driver and the key. Try to get used to that. I did this in Kiev recently. Okay? Then I was thinking, I had all these mafiosos. I was trying to teach them something. They want me to go... what do you call it? Advise the mafia in Ukraine. But we didn't work that out yet. I said, look at this, you know. And they said, what are you doing? I said, I have to do this every night, you know. And they said, what are you doing? I said, I'm making the sun come up tomorrow, you know. And they said, you do that every night, Geshe-la? I said, yeah, I do it every night, you know. Not a single night that I did it has the sun failed to come up. Okay? Thinking that the key starts the car is as ignorant. 50 years from now, people will look back at you and say, those guys, you know, banging on coconuts to make the sun come up. They think it has anything to do with starting the car. It doesn't, okay? They are both the car and the key and the hand holding the key have deeper causes. And they are both sprouting from a deeper cause. The car, the engine, the key, the person holding the key have all three sprouted from a deeper cause. If you want your car to start every time, if you want to make $250 million and know nothing about business, you better understand this. You see, it's extraordinary. It's something revolutionary. We taught it in Bulgaria. They were like, oh, I mean, that's a revolution. We want to have a revolution. They're always looking for an excuse to have a revolution. But it's like, you have sprung from a certain causes, and so has the key, and so has the car. Don't blame the key if it doesn't start the car. Work on the deeper causes, okay? That's something very profound, okay? People and the world with which they interact are both springing from a shared cause, okay? Work on that cause. You can have a beautiful partner. You can fix your husband. You can fix breast cancer. I had a lady 2 weeks ago. She's going for her big, mammogram. She had a lump. And she said, Geshe-la, I'm scared. And I said, don't be scared. Fix it. And she said, when? I said, before you take the mammogram, fix it. And she's like, well, how? I said, well, it has a deeper cause. Fix the deeper cause, you know. And then it will be benign. And if you don't, then you're taking a risk. I don't know, benign or what's the opposite? Malignant, you know. Fix the cause now before you go to for the mammogram. And she did. She did. And it was benign. You know her. She's in Tria Retreat. Somebody in Tria Retreat, okay? So it's relevant to understand deeper causes from which both the person and the growth are springing from other causes. You see what I mean? Understand the root causes of the two limbs. And don't think the left limb is causing the right limb, because it's not. The car isn't causing the key isn't causing the car to start. Nothing to do with that. They are both coming from a deeper cause. They are both separate shoots of a single cause. Got it? Then you're like, tell us the cause. And I'm like, no way, because I want you to come back after the refreshments. So we'll have refreshments. I'll stay here if you have a burning question or something you want to say hi. I'll stay here. It's now 8:20, am I right? Something like that. Can we say 8:35? Is that enough time for you guys? The bathrooms are pretty big. Let's say 8:40. Is that okay with everybody? 8:40, come back. Okay, I'm going to start at 8:40. Then we'll go. We have three more viewpoints to go. You didn't get the final one yet. Okay? Okay, enjoy.